This is exactly right.
This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Hi, I'm Erin Welsh.
And I'm Erin Alman Updike, and we're the hosts of This Podcast Will Kill You on Exactly Right.
We're back with our seventh season, which is bigger and better than ever.
Because guess what? We're now a weekly show.
This season, we're tackling everything from long COVID to norovirus, from the supplement industry to IVF, and so, so much more.
New episodes drop every single Tuesday.
Follow This Podcast Will Kill You wherever you get your podcasts.
Tell me the spelling of your first and last name.
My
descendant, I guess, is how you'd want to be titled.
Sure. My first name is Carrie, C-A-R-R-I-E. My last name is Nolte, N-O-L-T-E. And I am a descendant of Rebecca Briggs, a murder victim. And this is a ghost story.
It's creepy. It is a ghost story.
Do you believe in ghosts? If you've heard my audiobook, The Ghost Club, you know that I do, and you know why. This season of Tenfold More Wicked is a ghost story set in 1600s New England, and it's about a real death where the star witness in a murder trial was a spirit.
He describes feeling some weight on his blanket, like some heaviness, like something there, and it woke him up, and when he woke up, he saw what he thought was a spectral figure, he saw a light, and he said, who's there?
Our story features a man who went on trial for murder thanks to a ghost that hinted that it knew who committed murder.
I think you have sort of the seeds or the ground for people to run around saying, I am like the fire whisperer, right? Or I can interpret the dreams of people and help solve crimes based on what people say happened in their dreams.
This is the story about bad forensics, about a possible miscarriage of justice, and some big misunderstandings about fire.
Just because you've used an accelerant doesn't mean that it's like the magic sauce to annihilate everything you're trying to burn.
This is the story of a family scarred by past trauma.
You do get these kind of instances where families kind of turn on themselves and any member can kill anyone else. And you do get these relationships between mothers and sons where it does spill over into violence.
It's about a family forced into a complicated situation where maybe murder was the only way out.
He's saying something like, I won't tell if you don't. I won't bring up this if you don't bring up that. So that was conspiratorial. There must be something that each is trying to protect of the other.
Was this murder? Or was it something else?
Even the 19th century, in case I've looked at, there have been so many cases of individuals dying by being set on fire. And, it's always accidental. You know, they've got too close to a candle. They've got too close to the fire. They've been cooking and a spark has set fire to their clothing.
I think that she was stabbed. I think he set her on fire to cover up the wound.
Rebecca Cornell is not portrayed as being particularly stable either. She sounds like she suffered from depression and suicidal thoughts herself. Sad. It is very sad.
Everyone has a different opinion, but we'll meet forensic experts who think they have the answers, and they might just disagree with history.
So it is a story that you could hear the same information and still come away with a different idea. And it's so far back that it's not like we're going to go back and find the answers. But it's, the questions are always there.
I'm Kate Winkler Dawson, a crime historian and the author of The Ghost Club, American Sherlock, and All That Is Wicked. And this is our 11th season of Tenfold More Wicked. This is our oldest story yet. I know I said that last season when we were in mid-1700s Virginia, but this time we're traveling even further back to Rhode Island in 1673. Believe it or not, people still care about this case. I call this season Fire and Brimstone. I know 1673 already seems like so long ago, but for historical context, we need to travel back even further to England. Let's talk about the origins of the famous Cornell family, as in the Cornell University Cornells. The main character of this story is Rebecca Briggs Cornell. Women really play a big role here, and they might be the heroes, or they might be the villains. Carrie Nolte is the family descendant who brought me this story. I always need one of those to make tenfold, well, tenfold. Carrie's from Rebecca's line of the family, the Briggs, not Rebecca's husband, Thomas Cornell's side. Carrie works at Brown University, and she's a longtime listener. And thankfully, she accompanied me when I visited all of the important locations in this story.
I finally traced, on my dad's side, our lineage back here to Portsmouth, Rhode Island, and the Cornells. And looking at one of the websites, I think it was genie.com, it had an entire just paragraphs and paragraphs about the family.
Before this story became a historic Rhode Island murder case, the Cornell family had already endured its share of trauma. So let's start back in England, where Rebecca and Thomas Cornell first married.
Well, let's start with what you know about the Cornell family, because they were a pretty important family in the Northeast, I mean, all the way from the 1600s.
So the Cornells came from Essex, the Essex area, Saffron Walden, in England. They came over in 1638-39, and they had plenty of kids by that time. And they were still having kids, actually. I believe that Rebecca was pregnant and she gave birth to her son John when she was here.
So she is initially married to Thomas Cornell Sr., is that right?
Yes.
Okay. And they start out in England and then they move to...
They moved to Boston.
And why do you think they made the move? Or why did anybody make the move then?
Well, first of all, I mean, there was the religious separatists. So a lot of people would call them Puritans. And they do kind of fall into that sort of category. But the Puritans were much more stringent. Like when we think of Puritans, we think of the people that came and settled at Plymouth. Mm-hmm. And that was not them.
Carrie says that the Cornells came from England to America, or what would become America, during what is known as the Great Migration. These were Puritan-leaning separatist groups that came over. They wanted to worship the way they wanted to worship and live in communities that allowed that type of worship. The Cornells wanted out of England, and so they left and arrived in Boston.
There's a lot of politics, a lot of money going on, but it's also a real... just family fight between Anglicans, the Church of England, who had a lot of what they call Papist and Papal influences. So, you know, fancy altars, fancy stained glass and all that kind of stuff. And the Puritan people wanted all the fancy stuff to go.
Gloria Schmidt is a local historian who is an expert in Portsmouth, Rhode Island, which is where most of this story takes place. She says that we need to talk about religion a lot for context.
It's all important, and it's a framework. And I think you can't understand this story of what happens without understanding the spiritual ramifications of what is going on.
And this is around the same time as the Salem witch trials, right?
It's about 50 years before.
Okay.
That is certainly something that will... influence, like everything that's going on now, becomes something that influences the Salem witch trials later on and how people sort of reacted.
Gloria says that the Puritans were finicky about their religion and other religions.
Well, that's interesting. They would say that they would want freedom of religion, but what they wanted was freedom of religion for their religion and not necessarily for anybody else.
So what does that mean?
So there were people that they wanted to practice their faith, but they wanted their faith to be the dominant one. I think that the pilgrims were not as virulent about it. They were separatists. They wanted to be apart. I think that you had a lot of people that had no real opportunities in England. And so they would see America as a place where they might own land.
After Rebecca and Thomas arrived in Boston, they needed to support their family. They were both illiterate, but at least one of their children had been educated in England. Carrie Nolte says that they likely picked a profession that involved working with their hands, as many Puritan families did in the 1600s.
They were more likely people who worked with cloth. So they were probably weavers, that kind of thing. They probably had skill in that area. That's one of the reasons that they ran into trouble when they came to Boston, because they didn't have sort of a mercantile experience.
Thomas had several ideas for work, and weaving was not what he wanted to do.
So when they got to Boston, one of the things that they first tried to do was to run a tavern.
But was this unusual for people who were pious?
So taverns were, you know, there were places, there were meeting places, kind of in terms of the social order. They're primarily a meeting place. And actually, later on, it just had multifunction. So, and it was also for people who were coming in, didn't have places to stay.
And a lot of the time, you couldn't even trust drinking water.
The amount of alcohol was much, much less in the beers, in the ciders, and the kinds of things that they would drink. They would make things like grog so that, you know, you'd put in some hard alcohol and it would kind of kill whatever was lurking in there that you just didn't know was there.
Okay.
So it was really a focal point of colonial life, and actually a focal point of all life back in Europe as well.
But Thomas Sr.'s efforts at being a tavern keeper only lasted a year or two before he began making some mistakes.
That didn't go very well. Apparently, Thomas Sr. was fined by the authorities for putting too much alcohol into his brew, and he didn't know to not do that, and he didn't know that you weren't supposed to do certain things, and he actually went before the court and pleaded ignorance of this, and so they reduced his fine, but they said, you cannot be a tavern keeper anymore.
Thomas lost the tavern, and he and Rebecca discussed it, struggling to decide what to do next. It turns out that around the same time as they had opened the tavern, the Cornells had met a very special woman named Anne Hutchinson. Have you heard of the Hutchinson Parkway in New York? It was named after Anne and her family. Anne was unusual because she was educated in the 1600s when women really weren't.
In England, she was a follower of one of the ministers that went to Boston. And so she and her husband and their family, she had quite a large family. She had 15 children altogether. And they came over, and her husband was a merchant. She had a big house. She would start gathering people to discuss the sermons the day after Sunday.
She basically has these meeting groups in her home where they're discussing things, and you know, she was an electrifying speaker, and a lot of her ideas, she really starts running afoul of the Puritan leaders at that time.
The Puritan ministers didn't like that. There was a belief that God sent his messages through the male ministers, and in Anne's meetings in the beginning, they were all women.
But then their husbands started coming to this, and at that particular point, the ministers were afraid that she would send the wrong message. And in their culture, God acts on the community as a whole. So if someone was not following God's laws or God's way, the whole community would be impacted with a hurricane or something like that. So it was very important to keep everybody tightly under control.
But Anne was not one of those people you could keep tightly under control. She believed that the Holy Spirit talked to the individual, not through the minister. And this is a very important concept, one that drew a lot of people to her.
And Rebecca Briggs Cornell and her husband, Tom Cornell, are going to these meetings, and
they're going to these meetings. There is a reference in one of the books that I read to Thomas, you know, kind of being told to stop talking about it in public because they were really actually trying to control a lot of the speech. And you could back then. We didn't have, you know, freedom of speech the way that, you know, is espoused in the Bill of Rights and all that stuff.
We were
a colony, and we were English, and all of those practices and social norms and laws applied.
Right.
The ministers in New England complained about Anne Hutchinson and her meetings. But the Cornells found her intelligent and brazen and spiritual, as did many others. Eventually, Anne was arrested.
She had two trials. She had a trial in the church, and she had a civil trial. And, you know, at that particular time, if you weren't a church member, you couldn't vote, you couldn't have a business, you wouldn't own land. So being a member of the church was all important. And those people that started following her started to lose all those things. They lost their arms, they lost their vote, they lost their positions.
I mean, one of the things about this time period is that the religious and the political are almost never separate.
Mm-hmm.
And the experience of creating new governments, new settlements in these areas, and the marriage of politics and religion, government and religion, and the problems that they caused is foundational to the United States.
Anne was convicted and then banished from Boston. From there, she and her husband traveled 60 miles south to the area known as Portsmouth, Rhode Island. Anne is considered one of the founders of Portsmouth. Other people decided to follow her there too. And after they lost the tavern that had supported their family in Boston, Thomas and Rebecca Cornell decided to join them.
So there was a band that got together, and they wrote what we call the compact. And they were pledging their lives to be under God, but not necessarily under the church.
Anne and her group had the help of Roger Williams, a Puritan minister who had also been banished. Williams is credited with founding the colony of Rhode Island. They scouted around the area and eventually negotiated for Aquidneck Island, where they planned to settle. But the Pilgrims and the Puritans had no real control over the land because it was occupied by a Native American group called the Narragansetts.
Now, the Native Americans wouldn't have thought that they were selling. They thought more in terms of sharing the land. Well, we'll use it this time, and, you know, maybe 2 years from now, we'll be using it. But there was an actual transaction and actual signatures, and not just going in and taking the land. So, as I said, there had been good relationships in general between the Narragansetts and the people that came to Portsmouth.
This will become important, but for now, the Hutchinsons and the Cornells were neighbors in what would become Portsmouth.
And Rebecca Cornell was a very good friend of Anne Hutchinson. They were friends, they were about the same age, and I think that that was close ties. The Cornell land and the Hutchinson land grants, some of them are close together, so they were neighbors. And I think that they had come that far, that they were supporters of her and they would continue to support her.
It all seemed to be going well until the church authorities in Boston changed the rules. They decided that they could pursue people for breaking their laws about religion in other colonies, not just the Massachusetts Bay Colony.
And so this entitlement to come and take people to punish them for their own religious beliefs made Anne Hutchinson very, very nervous, and made a number of people very, very nervous. And they wanted to move beyond what they considered the reach of the Puritans. Because at this point, you know, the Civil War in England is raging full on. Nobody knows who's really going to end up in control of the government. And that has a huge impact on how people are going to be treated. So what Anne and a number of people decide to do is move to the New Netherland settlement, which is the area of New York and New Jersey and part of Long Island.
She went to the Bronx area, which was a Dutch colony, and she set up her family, and some of her family was older and they had stayed behind, but the younger ones went with her. And Rebecca Cornell and her husband left Portsmouth, left everything they had in Portsmouth, and went to the Bronx with her.
And Anne Hutchinson and the Cornells, they really couldn't have picked a worse time to move.
This is where the trauma for the Cornells really began. The history books say that Anne Hutchinson and the others from Boston got along well with the Native American tribes in Rhode Island, but in the Dutch colony of New York, things were very different. The Dutch did not have good relations with the Siwanoy of New Netherland, but Anne evidently thought it was worth the risk.
Anne was so frightened of the Puritans coming in because they kept harassing her. And I mean, there's no internet or social media, but there certainly were letters, and people would hear about the threats. And without her husband, after her husband died, she felt very vulnerable. So she felt like she had to go someplace because the Plymouth colony is not that far. Boston is not that far. And she was afraid that they would come and take her.
We aren't sure how long Anne Hutchinson and the Cornells were in the Bronx.
But it is time enough that they have a structure, a building. They've started trying to farm. And I think they're on a river, and it might have been what we call the Hutchinson River today.
They couldn't have picked a worse time to move to New Netherlands because they had just gotten a new governor, Governor Kieft, who decided to make the Native Americans essentially pay tribute to him, and that they weren't paying enough in taxes, even though he wasn't their leader. He was basically a usurper. I don't want to go into too much of their history, but there were a number of massacres perpetrated by Dutch people on the Native Americans in the area. And of course, the Native Americans
retaliated
for sure.
In the summer of 1643, Anne and the Cornells were trying to live in the Dutch colony, fully aware that the relations between the Dutch and the Native Americans were really bad, and they were getting worse.
The Cornells were at originally what is now Pelham Bay, and they also had some land across the bay on Long Island. And when they were starting to build their houses, which of course, you know, took a long time. There was a lot of hewing of wood and using axes and no nails, nothing, you know. As long as it takes to put up a house now, you can just add just months and months on that.
Anne Hutchinson, whose husband by this time had died, was also building a house.
And they were surprised, the Native Americans, that people were moving into the area, given the state of the situation with the Dutch settlement.
There's a lot of unrest,
a lot of violence. And her hired workers reported that Native Americans came over to them one day and took their tools from them and put them on the ground and took them by the shoulders and turned them around and started marching them away. And this happened at least twice. And one hired person quit.
Anne's workers took that as a warning from the Native Americans. It was time to leave. But when they told Anne about it, she responded with little concern.
I'm pretty sure that they were like, here's your warning. And she was like, I have always had wonderful relationships with the Native Americans. I have nothing to fear from them. They have nothing to fear from me. That was hubris in the highest degree.
The men went back to building Anne's home, and Anne assumed it was all going to be fine. They had been warned, but it wasn't until August of 1643 that Anne finally realized that she and her family, as well as the Cornells, should have left the Dutch colony much sooner. But by then, it was too late.
As a true crime buff, chances are you love a good story. And while looking for those stories over the years, you've probably signed up for at least a few subscriptions. From newspapers to streaming services, it starts to add up, and so do the bills. If that's you, Rocket Money will help you identify the subscriptions you actually use and cancel the ones you don't. Cancel those subscriptions in the Rocket Money personal finance app. Plus, you can also monitor your spending and they'll help you lower your bills all in one place. Once you sign up, all your expenses are imported into their dashboard. There, you can monitor your spending and implement new habits so you can meet your goals. Rocket Money even offers a concierge who will negotiate with your phone or cable providers to make sure you're getting the best rates. Join the more than 5 million Rocket Money users who have saved $500 million in canceled subscriptions. When customers use all of the app's features, that comes to about $740 of annual savings per member. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/wicked. That's rocketmoney.com/wicked. rocketmoney.com/wicked. Regardless of your outdoor space or lack thereof, there is a tree, plant, or flower to brighten it up. In fact, lemon, olive, avocado, and fig trees can all grow inside your home. No matter where you live or what you're interested in, fast-growing trees has something for your climate and your space. Don't have a green thumb? No worries. These experts can provide guidance on soil type, landscape design, or how to care for your plants. Once the plants arrive, Fast Growing Trees offers a 30-day Alive and Thrive guarantee and free plant consultations forever. I ordered an Autumn Blaze red maple tree, and it was so easy to plant. They give you really specific directions. It's easy to take care of, and I love seeing it grow. So I'm really happy with this purchase. This spring, Fast Growing Trees has the best deals online and up to half off on select plants. And listeners of this show get an additional 15% off their first purchase when using the code TENFOLD at checkout. That's an additional 15% off at fastgrowingtrees.com using the code TENFOLD at checkout. Fastgrowingtrees.com and use code TENFOLD. Offer is valid for a limited time. Terms and conditions apply.
In August of 1643, Anne Hutchinson and her family worked inside their still incomplete home. A group of Siwanoy men, led by their chief, raced into the settlement and rushed inside the home where they reportedly scalped the entire family, including Anne and four of her young children. One of the girls, 9-year-old Susanna, was out picking blueberries. When the Siwanoy tracked her down, they spared her because of her red hair, which was considered unusual. The story goes that she was eventually ransomed back to her family members in Boston. Everyone else was dead, including Anne. And the Siwanoy set fire to the home.
Anne's entire family that moved with her were massacred, save one. And this happened at a place known as Split Rock. The Native Americans came in and killed all the livestock, the dogs, domestic animals, scalped and killed Anne's entire family, except for one girl, Susanna, who was out picking blueberries and ran and hid in Split Rock.
Rebecca, Thomas Cornell, and their 16-year-old son, Thomas Jr., were horrified when they saw the fire over Anne Hutchinson's land.
Their settlement that they were building was about a mile away. So they were working on that. And at the time, they were across the bay, most of them, working on another house in the area. And they saw the smoke rising from Anne Hutchinson's house. So they set out to come and try and rescue any survivors.
The men hopped into boats and rowed toward the Hutchinson house.
So Thomas Cornell Sr. was on that boat.
I assume every able-bodied man who was in the area, the Cornells and maybe some other male members of other families, went on that boat to try and rescue or stop whatever was happening.
But as they reached the shore, they realized what was happening and they frantically tried to retreat.
They were intercepted by the Native Americans as they were coming ashore, and luckily they escaped, but two people that had tried to make the rescue mission were killed. Thomas Cornell is one of the ones who survived, as is his eldest son, Thomas Jr.
Thomas and Rebecca Cornell were devastated. Their closest friend and her family had been massacred. They knew they couldn't stay in the Dutch colony any longer. It was time to return to Portsmouth, Rhode Island, and to pray that the church authorities in Boston left them alone.
They escaped on a boat. So they left everything they had. They had daughters who had married in New York and stayed in New York. So the Cornells went back, but some of their family members still stayed.
So my direct ancestor is Rebecca Cornell Jr., and she ended up marrying someone in New Amsterdam and staying. And that's where my line kind of branches off from them. But Rebecca and Thomas Sr., Rebecca Sr. and Thomas Sr., went back to Portsmouth. But there was a lot of back and forth that he did, because he did apply for a land grant in New Netherlands and ended up getting it.
So despite the massacre, Thomas Cornell still wanted to have land in the Bronx.
Why would you go back, though, knowing about the tensions between the Native Americans and the Dutch? Why would you continue to try to be there?
I think money. I think a sense of righteousness. I think he my ancestor wasn't the only one who stayed in the area. He had another son who stayed, and he had another daughter who married and stayed. So he now had a family in that area and had this land grant that was just sitting there.
After the massacre, the Cornells, with their eight children, returned to Portsmouth to start anew.
So they go back to Portsmouth and they petition for some land, and they're granted about 100 acres in Portsmouth on the west side going up to Narragansett Bay.
Thomas Cornell Sr. was granted land to establish another tavern like the one he had owned before they left for New York.
There were some problems there because, you know, he was granted that land on provision that he would create a tavern. And taverns were very important in those days. They were the meeting spot, and there was a lot involved with that. And, you know, the fact that he didn't follow through with his promise is not very hopeful there.
This irritated the local government, but they didn't take the land away. Instead, Thomas Cornell built a house for his wife and their family, and they finally settled down.
So what did Thomas Cornell Sr. do in Portsmouth?
I think he was just a farmer. He certainly wasn't a tavern keeper. I think he gave that up. I think that they were focused on livestock, raising livestock. I think that they were familiar with that from the area that they lived in England, in Essex, in Saffron Walden. It was known quite a bit for their weaving ability, so the cloth that was manufactured there. So I think that they probably did that.
We think that weaving was Rebecca's department. She enjoyed using her loom by the fire at night. The family included a young man in his 20s named Thomas Cornell Jr. He's one of the main characters in our story.
Do we know anything about Thomas Cornell Jr. when he's younger or kind of at this point?
So there are some records in the New Amsterdam files that indicate that there was a Thomas Cornell who was in a militia. And of course, that would be something, you know, they would go out and they would fight the Native Americans. And, you know, defend and that kind of thing. And there's a report that he and another person were arrested for desertion. And the other man was shot, and he had a warning shot fired over his head.
Carrie Nolte says she can't be sure about those records, but the ages do match.
Now, Cornell is not an uncommon name. It could be that this is an entirely different Thomas Cornell. However, I think it stands to reason that if you wanted to assume that it was Thomas Cornell Jr., a young man who just watched neighbors that he had spent years with, that he had tight ties with, get massacred, he would be filled with some fury and want to go out and do something. So joining a militia makes sense. It also makes sense in the sense that we don't see a record of Thomas Cornell Jr. show up back in Portsmouth until the 1650s.
Rebecca and Thomas continued to work on the house in Portsmouth as Thomas Jr. helped.
So he would have been in his 20s, and would he have lived with Thomas Sr. and Rebecca at the homestead, this 100 acres you're talking about?
Absolutely. As the eldest son, he would have been expected to inherit the bulk of the farmstead. You know, there is a lot of tension comes in these colonial families from the divvying up of property once a parent dies. And it actually is one of the factors that drove westward expansion is the lack of resources once these areas started getting settled. So they would move westward in search of more land, more opportunity, all that kind of stuff.
It sounds like Thomas Jr. was staking his claim, working his father's land in anticipation of inheriting it all when he died. And in 1655, 60-year-old Thomas Sr. became ill, and then he died.
Let me go back real quick. So Thomas Cornell Sr. dies.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's just kind of old age, sort of, for the time, yeah. Let's say, for the time.
Okay.
Could have been a heart attack, could have been anything.
Nothing weird about that.
The Cornell family patriarch was gone, and the family buried him right there on the property. The whole family was devastated, especially his widow, Rebecca Briggs Cornell. They had been married for more than 30 years. The now 28-year-old Thomas Jr. comforted his siblings, and Rebecca decided to stay in the home. What choice did she really have? At this point, we need to fast forward about 10 years. Sometime in his 30s, Thomas Jr. married a woman in New Amsterdam. We don't know anything about her, except that his mother, Rebecca, adored her. She and Thomas had 4 children before she suddenly passed away from natural causes sometime before 1668. After losing his wife, Thomas Jr. and the kids moved into Rebecca's home in Portsmouth, staying on the top floor of the house. Thomas Sr. had not just provided for Thomas Jr., his eldest, but for all of his kids. And he had provided very well for his devoted wife, Rebecca.
Rebecca Sr. and Thomas Jr. are living together. As the eldest son, Thomas Jr. inherited most of the property from Thomas Sr. But there is a provision in the will that allows Rebecca Sr. to stay in the home in her traditional room, which was the best room of the house, as it was called. And Thomas Jr. had to pay her rent every year.
Thomas Jr. needed his mother, but he was also indebted to her. And things didn't seem too easy for him. More about that later, because it was a big problem. Then, in 1668, Thomas married another woman named Sarah Earle, who was from a very famous family. He was 41 by this time, and Sarah was 20 years younger.
The Earle family is a well-known and well-respected family in Portsmouth at the time.
Then they had children?
They had 2 daughters,
by that time, and in 1673, Sarah Earle was pregnant with her third.
Sarah, Thomas, and their six kids lived in the large house, but on the top floor, while Rebecca had the entire bottom floor all to herself.
Do we have an idea of whether or not Thomas was okay with this arrangement, that he gets all the land and everything, but that his mother has a certain amount of control, it sounds like?
Oh, yeah, no. Tensions were high.
Thomas Sr. died back in 1655, and now we've finally caught up to the main thrust of our story, which is what happened in February of 1673. Rebecca Cornell held the deed to the house and all of the land, and even though Thomas Jr. was set to inherit most of it, he had to work the land without being able to actually control it. Thomas Sr. had wanted security for his wife, and his will made sure she had it.
What he did in putting his will together this way was trying to take care of her. So she couldn't be cast out. She couldn't, you know, like, she had a place, a place of importance. But over time, over 20 years, this place of importance becomes just a nexus point of resentment and anger between Thomas Jr. and Rebecca.
In 17th century New England, men ruled society. But in Thomas Cornell's world, his mother controlled all of it.
In a patriarchal society, he is supposed to be the man, he is supposed to be in charge, but she holds the purse strings, and he has to go, for example, to Rebecca and ask for a 100-pound loan in addition to paying her rent to be able to farm and use the land. And this is set up, the rent is set up as a part of the will. So she's deeded the property to him in the future, but there's a rent aspect to it.
Rebecca Cornell had numerous children across the Eastern Coast, but Thomas was the one living with her.
One of the things that became a bone of contention is that Thomas Jr. was withholding his rent from his mother on the condition that she forgave this 100-pound debt. And it had her in such an emotional uproar that she actually spoke about it to her neighbors. And these are very contained people. You know, you don't talk about money. You don't, you know, say those things.
Rebecca was livid over her son's lack of reverence, and she complained about it loudly.
So he wouldn't pay this money back. He wanted it forgiven, and she wouldn't get the rent from him. And she needed that rent, that cash in hand, in order to pay her taxes. So there was this strife going on, and one of the reasons she didn't want to forgive it is because, you know, get your money back, it's a loan.
Rebecca didn't want to drain the inheritance for her other children. Thomas had to pay her back.
She didn't want to make things unfair for her other children, and so she was put between this rock and a hard place.
And remember that his second wife, Sarah Earle, was living there too, and that was another very big problem. Rebecca Cornell loved her son's first wife, but the second wife, according to Rebecca, was awful.
There was just tension up and down. It was an unhappy home.
Just wait. Someone in the Cornell family was going to die, and someone else would be accused of murder. But who? On this season of Tenfold More Wicked on Exactly Right.
The reason is a bit morbid is there was no such thing as funeral homes.
Right.
So they all had the front parlors for displaying of the deceased. So that most likely is where?
In this area?
Yeah.
At one point, there's a report that she had to intervene when Sarah Earle was chasing one of her stepchildren with an axe.
Oh.
And she was 70 years old, and she had to stop Sarah from chasing this child with an axe.
It's insanity.
It is. You can't make this stuff up. You really can't.
I mean, you see it in so many men who kill women, that you, how dare you tell me what to be, how to be, how are you above me? You are not, and I'll show you.
If you love true crime, check out my books, American Sherlock and All That Is Wicked. I also have an audiobook called The Ghost Club. I can't wait to tell you the real story about the world's most famous ghost hunter, who was the head of the world's most famous ghost club, and how he investigated England's most famous haunted house. This has been an Exactly Right Tenfold More Media production. Producer Jason Whaling, senior producer Alexis Amorosi, consulting producer Kyle Ryan, researcher Nicole Brown, sound designer Eric Friend, additional sound design by Nicholas Moonies, composer Curtis Heath, artwork Nick Toga, executive producers Georgia Hardstark, Karen Kilgariff, and Danielle Kramer. Follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Tenfold More Wicked.